Today's operation is the frustration of Vietnam in miniature.
I shall not see.
The worst area we've been in since I've been in Vietnam. Awful sick, and I'll be so glad to go home.
And I will not accept.
As men clamored over one another, pushing aside women and children in their panic-stricken fury, members of the air crew dragged them onto the plane, trying to fill it as fast as possible.
The nomination of my party for another term as your president.
For it seems now more certain than ever that the bloody experience of Vietnam is to end in a stalemate.
This is Dr. Stephen Nurse. These episodes of Is Abled focus on the brave men and women who fought in the Vietnam War, not the politics that surrounded the war. This is The War in Vietnam, Part 2. Those who were there are still fighting because the jungle changes a man. Well, again, this is Steve Nurse, and this is our second series on Vietnam. Again, not to be so political, but to see how the war in Vietnam affected people and affected families. And, you know, we know that the average person that went to Vietnam was about 19 years old. Just an interesting statistic, and a very sad statistic. Over 500 people were killed on their first day in Vietnam, and over 1,000 people were killed on their last day in Vietnam before they were leaving to come back to the States. Today, I've actually had the pleasure of interviewing two persons. Two Vietnam veterans. First of all, I've got Don Rudolph, and then I've got Robert. Robert, tell me, pronounce your last name before me again.
DeGrappa.
I like that. It's kind of, I don't know, it sounds kind of mean and tough, you know, and it sounds like you were kind of mean and tough guy, you know, when you were there. So
my grandpa spent time in prison for stabbing a guy.
Good. Well, then you come from a good line of people that are tough, you know. So anyhow, what we'd like to talk about in this half hour is expectations and what people. What folks, when they were going into Vietnam, what they were thinking about, at that young age, and we know that, first of all, there's a very good reason why we pick young soldiers, because young soldiers will do things. They don't have that many life experiences at that time, at least not lethal life experiences, and we'll do what they're told. And so let's talk with Robert here first. What were your expectations when you were going to boot camp? When you first kind of got into the military, you mentioned, you know, three things of why you went in, but what were your expectations? Going to be a piece of cake for you? Was it, what are you thinking?
I thought it was going to be a lot more difficult than what it was. To me, it wasn't as hard as our two-a-days in football in August when it was 105. I thought boot camp and even jump school, you know, when I went to jump school, we had Army, Navy, Marine, and Air Force personnel in jump school. We had Navy SEALs, you know, Marine Recon, and I thought it was going to be tough. It was just wasn't tough at all. I didn't think so at all. A lot of running, but that was no big deal.
And where did you do your boot camp?
Fort Knox.
Fort Knox.
I did AIT in Fort Knox as well, and then when I went to jump school, it was at Fort Benning.
Mm-hmm. In Georgia,
in
right?
In Georgia, yeah. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Don, how about you?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, I had no expectations. I was drafted. I do nothing about the Army. I didn't have a lot of time to really think about it before I went in. So I just did what they told me to do. But it was scary for me. I was more afraid, I think, during boot camp than I was actually in Vietnam. It was just, I was like a fish out of water. It was really, you know, the work wasn't hard. It was just the environment, you know.
Were there a lot of guys, do you think there were a lot of guys that kind of felt the same way?
Oh, probably. Yeah, I think so. It was just so foreign to me. You know, being drafted, it wasn't like I had this goal of going in the military and going over and, you know, killing people or whatever. I was just there, you know, and any expectations.
Had you already taken a draft physical at that point?
I had, yeah. I don't remember the total sequence, but I think I'd done the draft physical, and then I guess some time went by, and then I got the draft letter. I kind of vaguely remember that, and I remember, you know, doing my oath of whatever they call it, oath of office or whatever when you're first going in.
The thing that I remember, this is so funny, doing the draft physical, the last thing that they had you do, it's like the government does with everything, right? They have a list of organizations that were against the government or something, and you had to look down this list and sign if you had belonged to any of these, you know, the Communist Party and Latvian freedom fighters and everything. And then, as it's all government documents, at the bottom of this list of 500 organizations, they have other, you know, you get to put whichever you want in there. So, I think that's, and of course there were different, you know, different places. And, did you have any choice where you went?
No,
that's good. You don't want to, you're not going to get a lot of choices later.
No, I mean, you know, you line up, they cut your hair. I mean, you got guys with hair down to their shoulders, and it didn't matter what kind of hairdo you, everybody came out looking the same.
Yeah, I think that's one of the, again, in the movie, I think in Platoon, that's one, maybe Full Metal Jacket, where they take them in there, where they have the drill, where they just, that's the first thing is they're cutting all their hair.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
And then they have the mean drill sergeant in there.
I remember what they call policing the area. You know, it was dark, raining, looking for cigarette butts or anything that was out of place, you know, and it was crazy times.
Yeah.
But I was, you know, so disoriented by it. I actually saluted a sergeant who was in a dress uniform once because he looked important. And of course, he made me do 50 push-ups. So I did a lot of push-ups during that whole training thing. It was quite a learning curve.
I had to write a lot of sentences in school. And I had this one teacher that, Stan Mataya, and the sentence I always had to write is, "I will grab the bull by the horns and get to work." I will grab the bull, you know.
The bull by the horns.
If only I could knew how to, you know. Back then, we had no printers, you know. I couldn't have it print the same sentence over again.
Yeah, that would have been great.
I would have been really, if I could have invented that, I'd have made a lot of money. Mm-hmm. Robert, the soldiers you work with on a daily basis and going through boot camp and kind of getting ready for all that stuff, were they just in kind of an eclectic group, kind of a mixed match of everything, or was... Were they like you? Were they? How would you describe the group you went in with?
Well, they emptied out the ghettos during the Vietnam conflict. So I was from back east. So we had guys from, you know, Flint, Michigan, Detroit, Baltimore, Hell's Kitchen. You know, all the bad areas. A lot of draftees. You know, a lot of black guys. Very few wealthy people. Mm-hmm. I remember one banker he got drafted, and he was the president of a bank. So his wife sent him a 5-pound box of chocolates every day, which he ate.
Wow.
And he gained, in 2 weeks, he gained so much weight that they kicked him out.
Really?
Smart guy.
That is smart.
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, you know, who's the guy in... in MASH that was always trying to get out of the army.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, maybe that he just had the wrong thing. He didn't get the 5-pound box of chocolates every day.
Yeah, that was he couldn't even do a sit up. You know, after, so they kicked him out on, you know, and then you know there's the story of the guy who rode his motorcycle to formation every morning, you know, imaginary motorcycle, and he'd run, you know, and then they gave him a Section 8, so the last day he was in, he rides his motorcycle into the, you know, to the office, and he's, you know, run, and then he turns the key off and gets, swings his leg over and hands the keys to the you know, orderly and says, I won't be needing these anymore. True story.
That's,
you know,
hilarious.
Or, you know, there would be guys that say, look, tell the sergeant of the guard there's two guys in the latrine making out.
Oh.
And there'd be two guys in there hugging, you know, and the sergeant of the guard would come in and they'd get busted for, you know, they'd kick them out for homosexuality. You know?
Yeah.
Which they don't do now, you know. But
right.
They
right.
did then, you know.
Yeah. Well, again, you know, one of the people that we interviewed was Greta Kammermeier. And she was a nurse in, I think, in Da Nang. And she was with a neurological unit. So she really, and she was an amazing nurse, and came back and was eventually given the head of the whole you know, National Guard and stuff here. Uh-huh. And she came out as you know, being lesbian, and they, you know, dropped her, you know.
Yeah.
And so she had a big long legal dispute because of that. But you know, it's interesting that you know, it. I think that it's different when you have a draft army than when you have a, you know, just you know, volunteer or people go in. And I think that there's something positive about. I. What do you think? You think you should have a draft? You think that's a good way to go?
Yeah. You know, I think everybody should go in for 2 years. I know when I lived in Argentina, they were required, you know, I had friends that spent 2 years in the military there, and then they get out. I think, you know, places like maybe Switzerland and Finland and places in Europe have a mandatory 2-year, which I think is a good thing, you know, especially for disciplinary reasons. And like Don said, the military does teach you some very, very good things, you know, mm-hmm. how to take care of yourself. And even though you should have learned that at home,
yeah,
you know.
Well, in Switzerland, they were probably making those 5-pound boxes of chocolate for the guy that wants to get out. So,
I'd never heard of that one, but yeah, I remember you were talking about, you know, before you get drafted, you know, the physical, and there were people, all kinds of stories. They were taking, you know, boxes of cold medicine or drink 100 cups of coffee, anything to, you know, get the numbers off so they wouldn't get drafted.
Yeah, when I went through, the guy in front of me, apparently he was telling me, "Oh man, I had a lot of Robitussin last night." You know.
Yeah.
Well, they in 67. They were drafted in the Marine Corps, and when we swore in, there was eight guys that got shunted off to the Marine Corps, and they're like, "No, I'm a draftee. I just want to go in the Army." You know.
That happened to me. There was a guy, only one guy, but they said, and he's like, "No, not the Marines."
You know,
I think
man.
He was crying, man. He was like really upset.
You know, and the funny story was when I went in, I did not take it with me, but my mother insisted that I take a note to the head guy when I had my draft physical that says, "Steve has permission not to go into the Army." You know? I said, "Mom, it's not like it's not like recess. It's not like PE. You know, you still got to dress down. You know,
funny.
Yeah." But and I did get my at that point, I just never did get called in. You know, they were not. It was, things were kind of wrapping down, mm-hmm. and they were trying to decrease numbers, and
they heard about the note.
Yeah, they heard about the note.
Got you through.
Well, I think the problem is You know, they could have handled me. They just didn't want to have to deal with my mother. So, and then she spent, and bless her heart, she spent the next, she worked at Central Washington University. And she, what she did was she handled all of the, well, almost well, all the Vietnam vets that were returning back on the GI Bill and going back to school. So she handled that whole office.
Nice.
And she was really efficient at it and great at it. And, you know, and she said she got so many guys that came back that just, you know, they wanted to go to school. They wanted to do something, but they didn't know what they wanted to do. So she was kind of guidance counselor. And, you know, until the day she died, she had, you know, people that were, you know, calling her and thanking her for stuff.
Great.
So, you know, we all do our part. And I guess I'm getting a little bit off subject here, but that's kind of what I wanted to do and you know, and kind of doing these things is, you know, I can't tell my own story in Vietnam, but I can sure tell, we can sure tell others. And I think Rick and I both agree we've sure learned a lot on this. What were your expectations when you, again, you know, maybe you're going to say nothing, but Robert, what were your expectations when you landed in Vietnam? Were you kind of just planning on going out and just getting right out there and getting on it? Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, I mean, I wanted to get with it, you know. I mean, that's what I was thinking about. You know, I wanted to be in a war, and I wanted to fight in a war.
For the experience and the, just, yeah.
The excitement, the danger,
excitement.
You know.
You get to carry a gun legally, and...
yeah, you know, and, we were our own law. I mean, My Lai wasn't the only incident that... you know, happened over there.
Yeah.
It was the only
one
that was publicized, but it happened all the time.
You know, Lieutenant Callie, and
I mean, you know, you just can't ask, well, there was no rules of engagement, you know.
Yeah, and I think that that's, I think that's probably true. Did you go into many villages?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, one time we went to this village, and there was a, actually, a Catholic priest there, and he came running out to my. I was with my recon team at that time, and there had been unexploded ordnance that hit inside this walled compound. And he wanted us to take care of it, you know. So,
yeah, and I do know. Again, my friend Alan, he was. He said, and maybe you can respond to this too. Don, he said, sometimes I just kind of had an eerie feeling about, he said, I don't know where I got it from, but he was in a hooch someplace, and they were looking for rice and weapons and all kinds of stuff like that. And one of his, the people he was with said they kind of lifted up this mat in the hooch, and underneath it was a lot of rice, and he just said he kind of had a feeling this is not a good situation, and they got out of there, and later on this place just blew up, you know. I mean, it had all kinds of munitions. You ever kind of feel that, were there times when you just
yeah, I think instincts were really important, and I paid attention to my instincts a lot, you know. It was like, you know, left or right, you know, it's like, it's avoid that little area and let's go this way instead, you know.
Yeah, you know, which fork in the road do you take,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah. So I was, like I mentioned earlier, I was very, very lucky. There were many situations where I missed being killed by, you know, minutes. And,
yeah.
Yeah.
Well, like you mentioned, the one time when you, you know, got out of the, you know, you're leaving and the,
oh, yeah.
People down below you are getting all kinds of...
That happened actually several times, probably because of noise. The choppers would bring us in, or bring a fresh group in, pick us up and take us to someplace else. And then they were kind of disoriented as they were first getting there. And that was, the enemy liked to strike, you know, when people were a little bit unorganized, I guess you could say.
And if wherever there was a helicopter, there were...
Yeah, of course,
there were people.
Yeah.
So, when you were there and in the kind of in the middle of everything, and mm-hmm. and Robert, you were there and doing the same thing, the recon and all that stuff. Did you expect what were you expecting at that point, just to stay alive?
Well, I was actually having fun, you know. uh-huh. I had fun for about 8 months.
And then the last 4 months, it kind of went to heck on you.
Yeah, we had my team had ambushed some NVA and VC, and we were able to take care of a few of them and capture some weapons and documents. And I was stripping the body of the NVA. It was an NVA cadre captain, and I opened up his wallet, and there was a picture of his wife and two daughters. Mm. I was just like, I had never had it brought to me that personally before, you know. I mean, here was this man's wife and daughters, you know, and we just got done killing him, you know.
Yeah, I think, talk about that too, Don. Isn't that, I mean, I'm not trying to get political here, but mm-hmm. if we want to fight somebody, and whether it was the Japanese in World War II mm-hmm. or the Germans in World War II, you know, we kind of demonize a public.
Mm, definitely.
You know, I saw so many different letters that came back that talked about, well, you know, the jungles, there's nothing out there but gooks.
All right.
You know? Yeah. So, and again, please understand my listening audience, we're not trying to be non-political, but there were names put on these groups mm-hmm. that were demeaning,
sure.
that were there so we could make them less than human. Does that make sense to you, Robert?
I think that's all part of the training, yeah. you know, is to do that. Like, they're, you know, you're going to kill somebody whether they're less than human, you know. They deserve it almost. You know?
Right, right.
That's, you know, that's all part of the training.
Yeah. I mean, even if you look at World War II and the Holocaust, mm-hmm. I mean, that's the way the Nazis looked at the Jews as, you know, less than human, and
right.
and if you look at all the political posters, whether they were for government bonds or whatever during World War II, mm-hmm. you know, they were always wild caricatures, you know, of the enemy. Mm-hmm. When you were there too, Robert, you said the last 4 months it kind of really got to you. Is there a reason? Because you saw this picture of this captain and his two daughters.
His wife and his two daughters.
His wife and his two daughters. That must have really struck you. I mean, that here is another human being, kind of like me, that, you know.
And his wife was beautiful. You know how beautiful the Asians were, Don. Mm-hmm. And here was his two daughters, you know. And I ended up having two daughters myself later on. So, of course, that didn't enter into it at that time. But I just thought, what am I doing? You know. What am I doing here? You know, why am I doing this? I didn't know this guy, you know. And then after I got out of the hospital the first time with malaria, and then you sleep on white sheets and, you know, you get hot food every day, and we had a nurse come by every night and give us a rub down, you know. I didn't want to go back out to the bush after that.
Yeah.
I hadn't seen a toilet for 8 months, you know.
Yeah.
Or a hot shower, you know, and go weeks without a shower, you know. And then if you did get one, it was just cold water from a bucket, you know. It's,
yeah. Did you ever, Don, did you ever come into, excuse me.
Yeah.
Don, did you ever come into a situation where you kind of had kind of that realization that kind of what am I doing here or what, you know?
Yeah, definitely. Again, you know, I was there in later than Robert. So by 1970, not very many people wanted to be there. Not many GIs wanted to be there. And most of us.
The press was bad.
Yeah, the press was bad. And, you know, I thought most everybody was drafted, but I read the other day that only 25% of soldiers over there were drafted. But it seemed like most people didn't really want to be there, and we were just trying to stay alive. And so it was kind of almost quite, what am I doing here? How did I get here? And how can I get out of this place in one piece, you know? And I mean, it wasn't something I dwelled on, but, you know, occasionally you think, I guess I kind of thought, you know, we were like second-class citizens. We were the low, you know, the people that society didn't particularly give a shit about. They didn't care about us, you know? And
yeah.
And so here we were protecting democracy from the domino theory of communism, but we were also kind of the lowest of society. And then coming back home and being called names and treated that way,
yeah.
it was kind of a confirmation that, yeah. you know, so it's kind of like, why are we here? What
it's
are we
almost
doing?
Like, you know, like with college, you know, it used to be, if you, you know, the highest you could go is like get your doctorate or, you know, that kind of thing. And then if you didn't do that, you got your 4-year degree. Mm-hmm. And then if you didn't do that, you got your 2-year degree. And if you didn't do that, you went to vocational school or you did something like that. Mm-hmm. And now when you look at the statistics, the folks that are making the money are the ones that got into vocational school,
yeah.
you know?
Yeah.
I mean, it's the guy that, I can tell you, the guy that repairs my chipper and my my generator, you know, yearly, does pretty well fixing small engine, you know, mechanics. Yeah. And so I think that that's really true. Did you have, Robert, what were your expectations when you came back to the United States?
Well, you know, it wasn't my expectations, but you know, my family's expectations was, all right, go to school, get your life together now, and then society, you know, get married, have kids. So I enrolled in college. At that time, they were on the quarter system. And I remember, you know, I was 19 when I got back, and I couldn't vote and I couldn't drink because the law didn't change till 72. So I'm sitting in class and I'm listening to this young buck who was probably 28 with his PhD. Teaching, you know, and I'm looking around at all these other kids around me. They're my age, and I just said, you know, I'm not going to sit here for 4 years and listen to this guy, these people teach whatever that I wasn't interested in. So I had an apartment, I had a job, I had 2 cars, a motorcycle. I sold everything, and I loaded everything up in my NVA rucksack. I had a buddy of mine take me out to I-80. And I put my thumb out, and I thought, I got to get away from all this stuff. Because to me, I was free. You know, I didn't have to worry about killing anybody. I didn't have to worry about anybody trying to kill me. I didn't have to worry about snakes or anything like that or discomfort. I just wanted to just be left alone.
Yeah.
And I just dropped out.
Yeah. And that... Probably that is part of the PTSD, too.
Yeah, of course, you don't think about it at the time.
Yeah. Don, final thought?
No, I'm
commanding you. I'm commanding you to have a final thought. This will be your last
command. Well, I guess first I want to just say how much I appreciate your interest in us as a group of Vietnam veterans, because not a lot of people are real interested in hearing about our stories and that, so... I think it's really admirable what you're doing, and I just want to say appreciate that.
Well, thank you. And thank you, Vaishon, and thank you, Rick Ames, for also being a Vietnam-era veteran, or not a veteran, or I mean, you're and that's all, folks.
I decided I didn't want to be drafted, so I joined the Air Force.
There you go.
We have a little bit in common. They didn't appreciate me in the Air Force either. And that's how I got to work in the sewage plants. They said, let's see, you're a boy from upstate New York? Okay, it's July. We're going to send you to the Mojave Desert and work in a sewage plant.
Nice.
And it was smooth sailing after that, you might say. Then a couple years later in January, they sent me to Fairbanks.
Alaska.
So they never did learn to love me. You know? I didn't do my fighting over there. I did. The people, the multitude of draft dodgers versus the lifers.
Did you go to Fort Wayne, right?
No, I was up in Eielson.
Oh, Eielson, right. Yeah.
I was up north.
Well, it's just too bad you didn't know me at that time, because my mother would have written a note for you.
Really? I wish I'd known her. She probably would have come in handy.
That's right. And on that note, thank you very much. This has been a little lighter day, but very important to all of us. So you take care and have a great day, Vashon. And thank you, Don, and thank you, Robert.
You bet.
But it is increasingly clear to this report that the only rational way out then will be to negotiate, not as victors, but as an honorable people who lived up to their pledge to defend democracy and did the best they could.
April 30th, 1975 was the official end of the war in Vietnam. But to say it was the end of the war would not be giving all those who participated their earned respect. The collateral damage continues and causes suffering to this day. Dr. Steve Nurse, signing off.